Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, and earned degrees in English and History from the University of Kansas. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and since 2008, he's been the founder and CEO of American Majority, a conservative organization that trains candidates and activists. He's the author of a new book, The Adversaries, A Story of Boston and Bunker Hill. His name, Ned Ryan. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an amazing human being, Ned Ryan. Ned, welcome and honor to have you.
Thanks, Jack, for having me. I appreciate it.
You're an amazing person, but your mom and dad are also amazing people. Let's start with your mom, Ann. Tell us about your mom.
So, she's a hoot. She was a cheerleader at K-State. Actually, this is a funny story. I don't know if you know this, but on the day that my dad broke the world record for the mile for the first time, he's 19 years old. He's a freshman at the University of Kansas, and he breaks the record. First time an American has done it, held the record since, I believe, Glenn Cunningham. He is signing autographs. He's doing all of this press. Is finally done with that. Is frustrated because somebody has stolen his equipment. Right, his spikes and everything that he broke the world record in. So he's going to jog back to his dorm barefoot. And a young gal and her brother approach him as he's getting ready to leave. He's a little frustrated. He's been doing a lot of press and says, hey, you know, I go to school in Kansas as well. Would love to get your autograph. And my dad goes, why don't we do that later? And keeps running. Well, that was my mom. And about a year later, they get set up on a blind date. She's a cheerleader at K-State. My dad was obviously running at KU. And one of the first things she did is said, I bet you don't remember me, but I wanted your autograph last year. So now I want it now. So give me an autograph. And the rest is history.
And your dad has signed a lot of checks with his autograph.
Oh, yes, he has. Yes, he has. That's right.
Okay, your dad.
Yep.
A fellow by the name of Jim Ryan.
Yep.
In 2011, ESPN named him the best high school athlete of all time, beating out two guys, Tiger Woods and LeBron James. Tell us about your dad's track career.
So he actually had very little success athletically. In fact, was cut from the church baseball team. And then his sophomore year in high school, he's going across town. He grew up in Wichita, Kansas. He's supposed to go to another high school, Wichita Southeast, but he wasn't expecting to go to college. And Wichita East was actually a Votech school. He planned on being a draftsman and then going and working for Boeing once he graduated high school. Well, during orientation going into his sophomore year, a young former Marine drill sergeant stands up and talks about the sport of cross country. And my dad thought, well, you know what? I might as well give it a shot, seeing as I really want to get a letter jacket. Hopefully from that, we'll get a girlfriend. And so goes out for the high school cross-country team his sophomore year. Was utterly miserable the first few weeks. In fact, Bob Timmons, who ends up becoming his college coach and post-collegiate coach as well, didn't even know his name. Called him Max Ryan. So my dad goes from barely making the C team in the high school cross-country team to actually getting sixth at the state meet his sophomore year. And then that spring he runs, I think it was a 419 or 420 mile in a race in Kansas City. And Timmy pulls him up on the way back to Wichita and goes, Jim, I think you could be the first high school to ever break the 4-minute mile. And my dad thought he was crazy. And guess what? The next year he was the first high school to ever break the 4-minute mile, goes on to break the world record in the mile, the 1500, the half mile, made his first Olympic team as a junior in high school, would make two more Olympic teams, won the silver medal in 1968. And then, you know, it was just an incredible career. Made the cover of Sports Illustrated 7 times. And I think one of the greatest honors he's ever received was actually last summer when President Trump gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is considered the civilian equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. So an incredible honor for my dad. Only the second track and field athlete to ever win that. The other one being Jesse Owens. So incredible career, incredible man.
We're talking to Ned Ryan. How good of a runner were you, Ned Ryan?
You know, it was a good career in high school. Won the state mile, big class, 6A. One of only, I think, 3 father-son combos to actually do that. It paid for college. But I will say this, college was a disaster. Too many injuries to really actually ever do anything. But it did pay for college, so I can't complain.
All right. 2001, 2003, you were a speechwriter for President George W. Bush.
Yep.
Take us behind the scenes. What's the process to create a speech?
Well, technically, I was a presidential writer, so I was doing anything but speeches. It was special proclamations. It was special correspondence. You know, I think, Jack, the thing that I really struggled with going into writing for George W. Bush was you couldn't write in your own voice. You had to write in his voice. And I remember the first, I can't remember if it was a proclamation or a letter that I wrote, the deputy director of the correspondence office where we were housed, the writers, there were 6 of us, she sent it back with about 2/3 of it redlined out, called me in and said, listen, this isn't about writing well, this is about writing in George W. Bush's voice. So you're going to have to actually get adjusted to that, or you're not going to cut it. So the first couple of weeks were pretty brutal, actually, trying to figure out how to write in George W. Bush's voice to really be able to communicate his ideas, but in his voice. But once you got the hang of it, we were knocking out. I remember being able to knock out a couple proclamations and 5 to 6 letters a day. And it just became this process of just churning out a ton of content, which after a while actually got fairly old.
You were the Frank Caliendo before there was a Frank Caliendo.
That's right.
He knew a little more than you did, but.
Yeah.
All right. What's it like working in the White House?
You know, it was obviously a great honor. We were initially housed in the old executive. It's now called the Eisenhower old executive, which is right across Executive Avenue from the White House and the West Wing. But that's where about 90% of White House staff are actually officed. And we were there until 9/11. And I was there in the White House 9/11. And that was quite an interesting day, obviously, because we were told to evacuate that morning. We all of a sudden are seeing these reports. The Pentagon was on fire. One of my friends who was across the hall came and knocked on the door and said, hey, we might want to leave. But nobody really was actually connecting the points because we thought it was still a small airplane that had hit the Twin Towers in New York. The Pentagon had been on fire the week before from a laundry room fire. So we weren't really connecting the dots. So I was like, we should probably leave. We left our computers on. We left our jackets. And we just kind of strolled out. And all of a sudden, we realized about 2 or 3 minutes later, because my sister was still at the White House, and she came out, about 2 or 3 minutes after me and said, oh, my gosh, her eyes were, you know, this big. Secret Service had come running through screaming, get out, get out, get out. And we found out later it's because they realized Flight 93 might be actually headed to the White House. So, but after 9/11, we actually got moved down to the street to 18th and G, which is a very boring, windowless office building. And we're housed there. But it was really a cool experience to be able to say I wrote stuff that a president of the United States actually signed. So it was a great experience.
We're talking to Ned Ryan. When we come back, we'll ask him about the chapter of his life entitled Generation Joshua.
That's right.
And I'm Jack Crisul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisul. We're with Ned Ryan. Ned, in 2003, you're the founder and director of Generation Joshua.
That's right.
What was that?
You know, it was a program aimed at really helping primarily high school, but even junior high youth, again, most of whom were homeschooled. How do you actually become more civically aware? How do you become more involved in understanding the foundings of this country? Really becoming educated on the founder's vision for this republic, but then how do you put that knowledge into action? So it was a real blend of education, but also civic engagement, where we would take them out for the last 4 or 5 days And they would be on campaigns, doing doors, doing phones. Because I'm a big believer, Jack, that it's one thing to have ideas, but those ideas need to go into action. And it needs to be meaningful, purposeful action in the right places. So it was a lot of fun, but it was really one of those things where I wanted young people to learn more about where they came from, this country came from. And then how do they actually become engaged in actually making sure that this country continues to head in the right direction. So yeah, that was a fun 4 years. Lots of adventures, building something from scratch. And then I decided I needed another challenge and decided to start something new in January of 2008 called American Majority.
And that was a terrific, meaningful action. It's still going on. What is American Majority?
So it really is something I tell people all the time. I swiped a page from the left. I'm a big admirer of the left's strategy and tactics. And of course, I'm adamantly opposed to their ultimate policy goals. But the left's been doing this for a long time, Jack, where they've gone in and they've identified and trained people to run for state and local office. So school boards, city council, mayor, state house, state senate, in a meaningful, purposeful way, because they realize at the end of the day, politics is policy. And by that, I mean, if you don't win politically, you don't get to implement policy. And so we started January of 2008 with the idea of going, identifying good men and women, giving them the tools to be successful politically so they could actually win, to be in the right places, to implement the right ideas, the right policy. So, yeah, it's been 13 years. Pretty amazing stuff. We've trained in all 50 states. I've even done some advising and strategy overseas to help other countries get this going. But the whole goal being, if we can create a good bench of men and women at the state and local level, again, a lot of them will actually eventually go run for statewide or Congress as well. So it's really also about long-term building a farm team, a bench of good conservative leadership.
You're being humbled. You've actually trained nearly 48,000 candidates and activists. So a lot of people. If you want to learn more, www.americanmajority.org. You also have a bunch of online courses.
Yes.
Talk about those.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where I'm a big believer that in-person training is the way to go. But at the same time, there's only so many places we can be in person with American Majority staff. So a couple of years ago, we decided to do American Majority Online and really put training tools and courses where people could access them no matter where they were in the world. So we've got some really good candidate courses where people can go through and understand. A lot of running for office is a systematic, meaningful, metric-driven approach, but it's not rocket science. But you need to understand the different building blocks. And so I wanted people who were even thinking about it, who couldn't come to an in-person American Majority training, to be able to tap into our knowledge base through American Majority Online. So that's right. We do the in-person trainings, and then we've got the online courses as well.
www.americanmajority.org.
That's right.
All right. You were also part of something called the 1776 Commission.
Yeah.
What was that?
It was something that Donald Trump announced on Constitution Day, September 17th, last year, 2020, in which he wanted to put together a commission that would actually train future generations on what it means to be a patriotic American. And so this commission was put together. We were official commission appointed by, confirmed by President Donald Trump, in which we were going to go in and challenge what I call insidious fictions of critical race theory, 1619 Project that are being taught in schools as though they were fact, when in fact they're not. They're revisionist. In fact, they're deeply un-American, especially critical race theory. It's Marxism. And we put that together. We put out a report literally a few days before Trump's administration ended. And on day one, Joe Biden abolished the 1776 Commission, calling it counterfactual. And I think, Jack, the thing that was pretty interesting to me is we wanted to talk about American history. We want warts and all, right? We're imperfect human beings in an imperfect world. Everyone that's been involved with the founding of this country had their imperfections, yet at the same time, they were committed to this idea of a free American republic based off liberty first, last, and forever. Not always been true to it, but that was the goal and that was the aspiration. And the founders constructed the machinery of the republic in a very specific way. And the reason that they don't want this taught in public schools, Jack, is because I think if people were taught the original vision of the founders and how the machinery of the republic was constructed and how it's supposed to work, people might wake up today and go, this isn't exactly how it was envisioned. This isn't working how it was supposed to. There might be a problem. But progressives don't really want real history taught because it is actually opposed to what they are wanting and opposed to their worldview and undermine everything that they're working towards.
Following up about President Trump, let's go back the last segment, you talked about your dad.
That's right.
Being awarded the Medal of Freedom on July 24th, 2020. What was that day like?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it was one of those things where, again, you know, my dad, who's lived an incredible life, he was obviously a very successful runner, was a very successful photojournalist, was in the U.S. House of Representatives for five terms. Just an incredible life. And I remember the first conversation I had with President Trump. It was Memorial Day 2017. And we spent probably the first 10 or 15 minutes talking about my dad, because he is a huge sports fan. Trump is. And he's like, you know, I remember your dad in the 60s and the 70s, seeing his races. So we talked about him a lot. And then over the course of time, this was actually December of 2019. I had actually, let's just say I called out President Trump for signing the omnibus bill on Tucker Carlson in primetime, and got a call from him about a week later and said, hey, I saw your hit on Tucker. So we talked about that. And then all of a sudden we started talking about my dad again. And he goes, you've given me a great idea, Ned. I think we should give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And of course, I'm not going to dissuade him and say that wasn't my, you know, I didn't give you that idea, sir. I said, sir, that is fantastic. What do we do? He's like, you don't do anything. You can tell your dad, but he can't tell anybody, but we're going to make this happen this next year. So you go ahead and call your dad, let him know, and we'll figure out the details from here. So it's pretty cool. It was an awesome day. And the day itself was pretty amazing. Trump clearly was enjoying himself. We only had about 30 to 40 people that could come, but Matthew Centrowitz, who was the gold medalist in the 2016 Olympics 1500, Alan Webb, who had broken my dad's high school mile record. So there were a lot of friends and fans and admirers that got to be there that day. And at the last minute, Jack, this was funny. We had a few moments just with Trump and the family, and as we're walking in to the ceremony, he looked at my sister and me and said, hey, would you guys like to say a few words? And I said, of course, I would love to. So last minute, spur of the moment, he had us come up and just share a few words about our dad. And it was a really special moment.
And your dad in 1966 was named Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year.
That's right.
And also received the Salt Sullivan Award for the Best Amateur Athlete.
That's right.
We're talking to Ned Ryan, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Ned Ryan, and your latest book, Ned, is entitled The Adversaries, A Story of Boston and Bunker Hill.
That's right.
So let's go back 246 years.
Right.
1775. What was life like in Boston back then?
Well, it was actually a pretty grim situation because after the Boston Tea Party in December of 1773, the British government's response was to pass the Intolerable Acts, the Coercive Acts, in which, among other things, they shut down the port of Boston. They suspended the Charter of Massachusetts, which gave the colony the right to self-governance. They did a lot of things, Jack, that made life. They were trying to basically force the Bostonians to, first of all, pay for the destroyed tea. Again, it was an issue of also paying taxes that the British government was determined to get out of the colonies for funding the French and Indian War. But the situation in Boston was pretty grim. And in fact, the fall of 1774, the British government in America pretty much collapsed. As the colonists said, we don't think so. We're not going to just submit to these arbitrary authoritarian acts, and we will resist. So they started their own provincial Congress. They started drilling weekly in the local towns to prepare to protect their property and their rights to speech and self-governance. And the real nucleus of men that were leading the resistance in Boston, but really in the colony of Massachusetts, was Sam Adams, John Hancock, Paul Revere, and a young man by the name of Dr. Joseph Warren, who I highlight in the book, who was a young Harvard-educated doctor who was a protege of Sam Adams, but in those last 9 or 10 months before Bunker Hill, became the president of the Provincial Congress, a major general in the new army, and then on the day of Bunker Hill, goes to actually fight. But Jack, I think the thing that was interesting to me in my research for this book, a couple things. One of the last living survivors of Lexington and Concord was asked, why'd you fight? Did you fight because of the Stamp Act? And he said, I never saw a stamp in my life. Well, did you fight because of the Tea Act? I didn't drink tea and I didn't know anybody else who drank tea. Well, did you fight because you were inspired by the ideas of John Locke and other great English philosophers? And so I didn't read Locke. I only read the Bible, Isaac Watts' hymns, and the Catechism. And this person, you could tell, was perplexed. Well, then why did you fight? I fought because we'd always governed ourselves and always meant to. And Parliament and the king's ministers meant that we shouldn't. It was about self-governance, but it was even more than that. These English colonists had come over and colonized the American shores and brought with them these ideas in the Magna Carta, the 1628 Petition of Rights, the 1689 Bill of Rights. These ideas they considered sacrosanct because they encapsulated in black and white natural inherent rights they believe had been given to them by their creator. And the colonists were looking at Parliament and the king's ministers going, we have natural inherent rights that have been given to us by our creator. No earthly power gave them to us. No earthly power can take them away. And Parliament and the king's ministers said, no, you'll submit and comply. And if you don't, we'll send more troops and more warships until you actually do what we want you to. And the colonists said, we don't think so.
You mentioned Dr. Joseph Warren. I believe that Ronald Reagan, in his first inaugural address, said Dr. Warren was one of the greatest among the founding fathers. Tell us about this Dr. Warren.
He really, truly was an incredible figure, singular man. He only turned 34 a few days before Bunker Hill. And, you know, so this is well known, Jack, if you've studied the life of Dr. Joseph Warren. He had to borrow a musket. He had to borrow a horse. He went and fought in the redoubt on Breed's Hill. And as he's covering the American retreat that day, he's shot down by a British officer. And people have asked, well, why don't we know more about Warren? Because he died that day. And so in some ways, his story has been forgotten. But at that time, he was considered one of the most powerful and influential figures and really a driving force for this resistance to Parliament and the king's ministers. But really, not only in his ability to write, he and Sam Adams started the committees of correspondence. Many of those missives were actually drafted by Warren. He writes the Suffolk Resolves in September of 1774, which the First Continental Congress unanimously endorses, which was really one of those first documents that the British government looked at and realized, oh my gosh, the colonies are actually uniting around these ideas of independence and self-governance. And Warren was the author of the Suffolk Resolve. So really a driving force and spark for the intellectual, but also the organizing, Jack. He's one of the first guys to realize England's not going to let us go freely. We're going to have to fight for it. And he calls for a standing army. He calls for the militia to start training on a regular basis, starts calling for us collecting munitions and supplies. And I think the thing that was interesting to me, Jack, I'd always known that they had been training and drilling and doing all these things to prepare. I didn't realize how proactively they were actually smuggling arms in from the Netherlands and Germany into the colonies, cannons, gunpowder, muskets, to prepare to fight for their freedom.
We're talking to Ned Ryan. If you want to learn more, www.americanmajority.org. And we're talking about his latest book, The Adversaries, A Story of Boston and Bunker Hill. Ned, how did that group of modern-day David versus Goliath patriots ever beat the strongest army in the world at the time, Britain?
You know, it's one of those things where the Americans, so Hugh Lord Percy is one of the senior British officers in Boston at the time. And after the Day of Lexington and Concord, they had been very dismissive of the Americans' ability to fight. He comes back and tells Gage they have men among them who know what they're doing. So the Americans were actually far better trained and ready to fight than the British should actually give them credit for. It became one of those things where the British came in very arrogantly. You know, on the day of Bunker Hill, it kind of encapsulated a little bit of what played out over the next 6 years. The British weren't as well trained, were not as, you know, equipped at fighting. Some of them hadn't even fought for a decade or more before Bunker Hill. And all of a sudden they realized these New Englanders who actually for generations had been at war, from King Philip's War to the French and Indian War until the modern day at the time, they knew how to fight. And they were fighting for their freedoms. They were fighting based off these principles in which they felt they had a right to them, but they also had an obligation, Jack, to defend these rights they believe had been given to them by their transcendent creator. So it became this whole idea, they're fighting for their land, they're fighting for their freedoms, and they're fighting for the right to found a free American republic. And the British finally, after 6 years, obviously with Cornwallis and the surrender at Yorktown, realized, we've lost the colonies. Let's figure out peace and move forward. It really is one of those things where if they had actually been able to find some sort of compromise in 1774 and 1775, it might have actually led to a golden age of incredible growth for revenue and profit between the American colonies and England. But instead, Parliament and the King's ministers decided, no, we've made these laws. You're going to submit to them. And it led to a massive, significant loss of life. But Jack, the other thing that people don't really discuss, it basically doubled the national debt of England, when in fact, if they had actually reached a peaceful compromise, it could have led to incredible revenue for both the colonies and for England.
All right, let's jump ahead 246 years to today.
Give us
a one-minute commentary on America today.
We have to go back and understand how this republic is supposed to work, where our rights come from. They don't come from the government. They come from a transcendent creator. Government is meant to protect those rights and take none of them away. So we have to go back and discuss, where do our rights come from? What is the role of government? But Jack, even more so, we always think of our rights. You know, the founders truly believed in property rights, obviously property of house and land and all these things. But they truly believed that anything inherent to the individual, there was a property in rights, our right to conscience, our right to speech, a right to all of these things that no government can take away. I think we have conceded so much as an American people in 21st century because we don't fully understand where our rights come from. Therefore, we don't know how to defend them. So I think that's something that we need to really have a conversation about.
We're talking to Ned Ryan, and I'm Jack Rasul. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Ned Ryan. And since 2008, he's been the founder and CEO of American Majority, a conservative organization that trains candidates and activists, and they've trained 48,000 of them. Okay, you hear a lot today about government for the people versus the people for government. And I think in the first State of the Union, President Biden referred to the people for the government. What's right. The difference?
You know, in my first book, Restoring Our Republic, I juxtaposed the founders versus the progressives, and the founders being optimistic realists who were realists about human nature, right? Imperfect human beings in an imperfect world should never be trusted with consolidated power. But they were optimistic they could form a government that would protect all of these the Americans' God-given rights, at the same time taking none of them away, at the same time never giving consolidated power to individual human beings. And they created this machinery of the republic, this diffusion of power, because they believed that the state was supposed to serve man. Progressives got it all wrong. Their utopian state is they believe that you should actually consolidate power in the state to advance progress, to somehow reach utopia and nirvana here on Earth. And they had a deeply dangerous, naively dangerous view of human beings and human nature. They believed it could be perfectible. Therefore, it wasn't a problem to consolidate power into the hands of a relatively small, educated elite, and to build this administrative state that we're now experiencing. And they truly believe in many ways, Jack, it's the age-old struggle. Does the state serve man, or does man serve the state? They actually believe that the state gives rights, that man in many ways is subservient to the state. And so if you were to look at how the founders and the progressives have wildly divergent views on human nature and the role of government, we're seeing it play out today, in which we're realizing the administrative state and the progressive view of it, we're really living that vision, and we've got to figure out how we can restore the republic and get back to the founders' vision, in which there is a need for government. We're not angels, right? We're no angels. There's a need for government. At the same time, it's supposed to be light touch to allow us the greatest amount of freedom and liberty to pursue our God-given rights.
We're talking to Ned Ryan. If you want to learn more, www.americanmajority.org. I quote you now, Ned. History done well is like the wind behind our backs.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of the reasons I wrote The Adversaries, a story of Boston and Bunker Hill, is to highlight the life of Dr. Joseph Warren, but others as well, to not only for people to read it and to become better acquainted, but to be inspired and to be driven, to be motivated into action. History done well is like the wind at our backs. It should motivate us into action. As we understand, men like Warren and others, they were faced with very tough choices. It wasn't as though danger was 3,000 miles away in London. There were literally thousands of British soldiers in Boston. And on the day that he gave the oration for the fifth anniversary of the Boston Massacre, 30 to 40 British officers came and sat on the very steps of the pulpit right in front of Warren, mere feet away, as he is speaking to 5,000 gathered Bostonians. And it's one of those things where a lot of hard decisions were made, danger very close and a present threat to their lives and to their livelihoods. And yet they still made these courageous decisions and ultimately said, these are the principles we believe on. We will not compromise. And when the British said, we will not allow you to do this, they said, we will fight for our rights and we're willing to fight and actually die for them. So it's just an incredible story that we should be inspired by and realize these guys gave everything for us to be free because they were committed to these ideas of freedom. I don't think we have to make such dramatic choices. At the same time, their lives and their actions should inspire us to do something today. I'm encouraged, Jack. Last thing I'll say is this. I'm starting to see a renewal of the American spirit rising up in the face of this critical race theory and the school boards in which parents are saying, we don't think so. We are in charge and you will not indoctrinate our children in deeply un-American ideas. And if you don't like it, we're going to recall you and run you out of office.
We're 6 months into the Biden presidency now. What's amazed you the most these last 6 months?
How bad it really is. Just the inflation, immigration. It's a humanitarian disaster on the border. Everything that has been done so quickly in the last 5 or 6 months. Listen, I knew it was going to be a disaster. Biden's not really calling the shots. Let's not kid ourselves. He's an empty husk in which people that are much further left than the great majority of Americans are the ones actually calling the shots. I think the acceleration that we've seen in some of these things, whether it's been the inflation, whether it's the immigration disaster, I knew this was going to happen, but it's happened a little bit faster than I thought it would.
All right. Talk to us about the thirst for the religion of power.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this is the one thing that you can always be convinced of, that the left is dedicated to the power, the religion of politics. And it is a lust for power. They will do anything to get to power because they truly believe that they are the most enlightened, educated people. And you dirty little deplorable peasants out there just simply don't know what's best for you. Therefore, we need to be in power to help you become more enlightened. But it's always been this quest for power. I've said this, Jack, on Tucker's show and in op-eds. We have to figure out and understand we are dealing with a bunch of religious zealots. Politics is their religion. The administrative state is their holy of holies. Politics is not our religion. It's a necessary evil. But at the same time, if we don't meet their passion with our own passion, we're not going to restore the republic. We will go on this path of basically slouching towards statism, which eventually leads to communism.
Okay, speaking of absolute power, talk to us about the big tech titans, modern-day oligarchs.
Yeah, this is something I was one of the first to really become pretty outspoken about it several years ago, in which I said these guys are becoming a power in and of themselves. They're becoming the arbiters of free speech and the free flow of information, these private corporations, when in fact, in a government of, by, and for the people, they make their elected representatives, who are accountable to the people, the stewards of the power and money that the people have given to them, to actually advance the priorities and interests of and rights of the American people. And I think our elected representatives, both Republicans and Democrats, have completely failed the American people by allowing these private corporations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, to be the arbiters of free speech, to be able to decide the free flow of information. That's not how it's supposed to work. And at some point, we're going to have real leadership that addresses these monopolies and say, we're not going, first of all, The thing, Jack, that I keep on saying is it is a Republican tradition to break monopolies, right? Reagan did it. Theodore Roosevelt did it. And you have to do that because you cannot have a free market dynamic when sectors are dominated by monopolies. So Republicans are going to have to get righteous on this. And I would say this, Jack, the first thing they have to do is they have to look at tech companies and go, we renounce big tech and all its evil works, right? We're not going to accept direct cash contributions. We're going to have a very strong approach, remove 230 exemptions, break the monopolies. And I would actually argue, I've written some stuff about this, break the revenue model, because the future of the republic is at stake.
We're talking to Ned Ryan. And if the man got a little courage to speak his piece, He'd be pretty good someday. So just joking. Okay, I quote you, Ed. Purposeful, meaningful action is the soul of revolution.
That's right.
What can we do? If we say anything, we're cancel culture.
Well, first of all, this is one of the things. They can call you any name in the book. I've been called every name in the book. I've been on, you know, MSNBC and CNN don't have me anymore for some strange reason. But it's not to be afraid of what they'll call you. It's to be afraid of what might happen if you don't do anything. And again, people have asked me all the time, what should we do? You have to engage in meaningful, purposeful action. I mean, this thing that's taking place here in Loudoun County, Virginia, where I'm at, in addressing the school board, Ian Pryor and some of the others here, and I'm helping them out now, have decided, okay, school board, if you're not going to listen to our concerns about critical race theory, we're going to collect signatures and recall you. And so, Jack, I would say this. This has to be across the country. If you sit back and take it and accept what they are doing, we will lose the country. People have to engage and go above and beyond what they've done in the past to realize if we do not do something, it will be lost because the left is relentless. We have to meet their passion with our own. So I would say this. Don't be afraid of what they might call you. Be far more afraid of what will happen if you do nothing.
We hear a lot about equity versus equality. What's the difference?
We all are created equal in the sight of God. We all have the equal opportunity. This is the American dream. You have equal opportunity to be able to pursue your dreams and your talents, to go and succeed, hopefully, at whatever you do. But success is obviously up to how hard you're willing to work. We are equal in the sight of God. It doesn't mean that we will have equal outcomes in our pursuits. And one of the things that the progressive left wants to try and do is have equality of outcome, not equal opportunities. And that's a huge difference because when you are forcing the equality of outcomes, you're basically removing any incentive for people to fully pursue and achieve their God-given talents, whether it's in, you know, an entrepreneurial way of starting a small business or whatever it is, Jack. So, yeah, equal opportunity to succeed or fail is massively different than equity and equal outcomes.
Ned Ryan, you're a modern day Paul Revere.
I appreciate
the horse.
That's right.
Okay, keep it up. This
Thank
is
you.
What we need in our country.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening and make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.
Believe in yourself.